stopped as if begging for an answer. She did not answer. He asked anxiously,
"You haven't changed your mind about it, have you?"
"About what?"
"About that medal."
"No, Jim, I have not changed my mind."
"They're experts, though. The men on that committee. Top experts, chief metallurgists for the biggest corporations with a string of degrees from universities all over the country."
He said it unhappily, as if he were begging her to make him doubt these men and their verdict. She watched him, puzzled. This was not like him. The car jerked forward. It moved slowly through a gap in a plank barrier, past the hole of a broken water main. She saw the new pipe stacked by the excavation. The pipe bore a trademark. Stockton Foundry, Colorado. She looked away. She wished she were not reminded of Colorado.
"I can't understand it," said Taggart miserably. "The top experts of the National Council of Metal Industries."
"Who's the president of the National Council of Metal Industries, Jim?" "Orrin Boyle, isn't it?" Taggart did not turn to her, but his jaw snapped open.
"If that fat slob thinks he can—"
He started, but stopped, and did not finish. She looked up at a street lamp on the corner. It was a globe of glass filled with light. It hung secure from storm, lighting boarded windows and cracked sidewalks, as their only guardian. At the end of the street across the river, against the glow of a factory, she saw the thin tracing of a power station. A truck went by, hiding her view. It was the kind of truck that fed the power station, a tank truck, its bright new paint impervious to sleet, green, with white letters, Wyatt Oil, Colorado.
"Dagny, have you heard about that discussion at the Structural Steelworkers Union meeting in Detroit?"
"No, what discussion?"
"It was in all the newspapers. They debated whether their members should or should not be permitted to work with Reardon Metal. They didn't reach a decision, but that was enough for the contractor who was going to take a chance on Reardon Metal. He canceled his order, but fast. What if everybody decides against it?"
"Let them." A dot of light was rising in a straight line to the top of an invisible tower. It was the elevator of a great hotel. The car went past the building's alley. Men were moving a heavy crated piece of equipment from a truck into the basement. She saw the name on the crate. Nielsen Motors, Colorado.
"I don't like that resolution passed by the Convention of the Grade School Teachers of New Mexico," said Taggart.
"What resolution?"
"They resolved that it was their opinion that children should not be permitted to ride on the new Rio Norte line of Taggart Transcontinental when it's completed because it is unsafe. They said it specifically. The new line of Taggart Transcontinental. It was in all the newspapers. It's terrible publicity for us. Dagny, what do you think we should do to answer them?"
"Run the first train on the new Rio Norte line." He remained silent for a long time. He looked strangely dejected. She could not understand it. He did not gloat. He did not use the opinions of his favorite authorities against her. He seemed to be pleading for reassurance. A car flashed past them. She had a moment's glimpse of power, a smooth, confident motion and a shining body. She knew the make of the car. Hammond, Colorado.
"Dagny, are we? Are we going to have that line built? On time?"
It was strange to hear a note of plain emotion in his voice. The uncomplicated sound of animal fear. "God help this city if we don't," she answered. The car turned a corner. Above the black roofs of the city, she saw the page of the calendar hit by the white glare of a spotlight. It said, January 29th.
"Dan Conway is a bastard."
The words broke out suddenly, as if he could not hold them any longer. She looked at him bewildered.
"Why?" "He refused to sell us the Colorado track of the Phoenix Durango."
"You didn't." She had to stop. She started again, keeping her voice flat in order not to scream. "You haven't approached him about it?"
"Of course I have."
"You didn't expect him to sell it to you?"
"Why not?"
His hysterically belligerent manner was back.
"I offered him more than anybody else did. We wouldn't have had the expense of tearing it up and carting it off. We could have used it as is. And it would have been wonderful publicity for us that we're giving up the Reardon metal track in deference to public opinion. It would have been worth every penny of it in goodwill. But the son of a bitch refused. He's actually declared that not a foot of rail would be sold to Tagger Transcontinental. He's selling it piecemeal to any stray comer, to one-horse railroads in Arkansas or North Dakota, selling it at a loss, way under what I offered him. The bastard doesn't even want to take a profit. And you should see those vultures flocking to him. They know they'd never have a chance to get rail anywhere else.
She sat, her head bowed. She could not bear to look at him.
I think it's contrary to the intent of the anti-dog-eat-dog rule, he said angrily. I think it was the intent and purpose of the National Alliance of Railroads to protect the essential systems, not the jerkwaters of North Dakota. But I can't get the Alliance to vote on it now, because they're all down there outbidding one another for that rail.
She said slowly, as if she wished it were possible to wear gloves to handle the words. I see why you want me to defend Reardon Metal.
I don't know what you're...
Shut up, Jim, she said quietly. He remained silent for a moment. Then he drew his head back and drawled defiantly,
You'd better do a good job of defending Reardon Metal, because Bertram Scudder can get pretty sarcastic.
Bertram Scudder?
He's going to be one of the speakers tonight.
One of the... You didn't tell me there were to be other speakers.
Well, I... What difference does that make? You're not afraid of him, are you?
The New York Business Council? And you invite Bertram Scudder?
Why not? Don't you think it's smart? He doesn't have any hard feelings toward businessmen, not really. He's accepted the invitation. We want to be broad-minded and hear all sides and maybe win him over.
Well, what are you staring at?
You'll be able to beat him, won't you?
To beat him?
On the air. It's going to be a radio broadcast. You're going to debate with him the question, is Reardon Metal a lethal product of greed?
She leaned forward. She pulled open the glass partition of the front seat, ordering, Stop the car. She did not hear what Taggart was saying. She noticed dimly that his voice rose to screams.
They're waiting. 500 people at the dinner and a national hookup. You can't do this to me.
He seized her arm, screaming,
But why?
You goddamn fool. Do you think I consider their question debatable? The car stopped. She leaped out and ran. The first thing she noticed after a while was her slippers. She was walking slowly, normally, and it was strange to feel the iced stone under the thin soles of black satin sandals. She pushed her hair back off her forehead and felt drops of sleet melting on her palm. She was quiet now. The blinding anger was gone. She felt nothing but a gray weariness. Her head ached a little. She realized that she was hungry, and remembered that she was to have had dinner at the business council. She walked on. She did not want to eat. She thought she would get a cup of coffee somewhere, then take a cab home. She glanced around her. There were no cabs in sight. She did not know the neighborhood. It did not seem to be a good one. She saw an empty stretch of space across the street, an abandoned park encircled by a jagged line that began as distant skyscrapers and came down to factory chimneys. She saw a few lights in the windows of dilapidated houses, a few small grimy shops closed for the night, and the fog of the East River 2 blocks away. She started back toward the center of the city. The black shape of a ruin rose before her. It had been an office building long ago. She saw the sky through the naked steel skeleton and the angular remnants of the bricks that had crumbled. In the shadow of the ruin, like a blade of grass fighting to live at the roots of a dead giant, there stood a small diner. Its windows were a bright band of glass and light. She went in. There was a clean counter inside with a shining strip of chromium at the edges. There was a bright metal boiler and the odor of coffee. A few derelicts sat at the counter. A husky, elderly man stood behind it, the sleeves of his clean white shirt rolled at the elbows. The warm air made her realize in simple gratitude that she had been cold. She pulled her black velvet cape tight about her and sat down at the counter. A cup of coffee, please, she said. The men looked at her without curiosity. They did not seem astonished to see a woman in evening clothes enter a slum diner. Nothing astonished anyone these days. The owner turned impassively to fill her order. There was, in his stolid indifference, the kind of mercifulness that asks no questions. She could not tell whether the four at the counter were beggars or working men. Neither clothes nor manner showed the difference these days. The owner placed a mug of coffee before her. She closed both hands about it, finding enjoyment in its warmth. She glanced around her and thought, in habitual professional calculation, how wonderful it was that one could buy so much for a dime. Her eyes moved from the stainless steel cylinder of the coffee boiler to the cast-iron griddle, to the glass shelves, to the enameled sink, to the chromium blades of a mixer. The owner was making toast. She found pleasure in watching the ingenuity of an open belt that moved slowly, carrying slices of bread past glowing electric coils. Then she saw the name stamped on the toaster. Marsh, Colorado. Her head fell down on her arm on the counter.
"It's no use, lady,"
said the old bum beside her. She had to raise her head. She had to smile in amusement, at him and at herself. "It isn't?" she asked.
"Nah, forget it. You're only fooling yourself."
"About what?"
"About anything being worth a damn. It's dust, lady, all of it, dust and blood. Don't believe the dreams they pump you full of, and you won't get hurt."
"What dreams?"
"The stories they tell you when you're young, about the human spirit. There isn't any human spirit. Man is just a low-grade animal, without intellect, without soul, without virtues or moral values. An animal with only two capacities, to eat and to reproduce."
His gaunt face, with staring eyes and shrunken features that had been delicate, still retained a trace of distinction. He looked like the hulk of an evangelist, or a professor of aesthetics who had spent years in contemplation in obscure museums. She wondered what had destroyed him. What error on the way could bring a man to this?
"You go through life looking for beauty, for greatness, for some sublime achievement," he said. "And what do you find? A lot of trick machinery for making upholstered cars or inner spring mattresses."
"What's wrong with inner spring mattresses?"
said a man who looked like a truck driver.
"Don't mind him, lady. He likes to hear himself talk. He don't mean no harm."
"Man's only talent is an ignoble cunning for satisfying the needs of his body," said the old bum. "No intelligence is required for that. Don't believe the stories about man's mind, his spirit, his ideals, his sense of unlimited ambition."
"I don't," said a young boy who sat at the end of the counter. He wore a coat ripped across one shoulder. His square-shaped mouth seemed formed by the bitterness of a lifetime.
"Spirit," said the old bum. "There's no spirit involved in manufacturing or in sex. Yet these are man's only concerns, matter. That's all men know or care about. As witness our great industries, the only accomplishment of our alleged civilization, built by vulgar materialists with the aims, the interests, and the moral sense of hogs. It doesn't take any morality to turn out a 10-ton truck on an assembly line."
"What is morality?" she asked.
"Judgment to distinguish right and wrong, vision to see the truth, courage to act upon it, dedication to that which is good, integrity to stand by the good at any price. But where does one find it?"
The young boy made a sound that was half chuckle, half sneer. "Who is John Galt?" She drank the coffee, concerned with nothing but the pleasure of feeling as if the hot liquid were reviving the arteries of her body. "I can tell you," said a small, shriveled tramp who wore a cap pulled low over his eyes.
"I know."
Nobody heard him or paid any attention. The young boy was watching Dagny with a kind of fierce, purposeless intensity. "You're not afraid," he said to her suddenly, without explanation, a flat statement in a brusque, lifeless voice that had a note of wonder. She looked at him. "No," she said, "I'm not."
"I know who is John Galt," said the tramp. "It's a secret, but I know it."
"Who?" she asked, without interest.
"An explorer," said the tramp. "The greatest explorer that ever lived. The man who found the fountain of youth."
"Give me another cup, Black,"
said the old bum, pushing his cup across the counter.
"John Galt spent years looking for it. He crossed oceans and he crossed deserts, and he went down into forgotten mines, miles under the earth. But he found it, on the top of a mountain. It took him 10 years to climb that mountain. It broke every bone in his body. It tore the skin off his hands. It made him lose his home, his name, his love, but he climbed it. He found the fountain of youth, which he wanted to bring down to men. Only he never came back.
Why didn't he? She asked.
Because he found that it couldn't be brought down.
The man who sat in front of Reardon's desk had vague features and a manner devoid of all emphasis, so that one could form no specific image of his face, nor detect the driving motive of his person. His only mark of distinction seemed to be a bulbous nose, a bit too large for the rest of him. His manner was meek, but it conveyed a preposterous hint, the hint of a threat deliberately kept furtive, yet intended to be recognized. Reardon could not understand the purpose of his visit. He was Dr. Potter, who held some undefined position with the State Science Institute. "What do you want?" Reardon asked for the third time.
"It is the social aspect that I am asking you to consider, Mr. Reardon," the man said softly. "I urge you to take note of the age we're living in. Our economy is not ready for it."
"For what?"
"Our economy is in a state of extremely precarious equilibrium. We all have to pool our efforts to save it from collapse."
"Well, what is it you want me to do?"
"These are the considerations which I was asked to call to your attention. I am from the State Science Institute, Mr. Reardon."
"You've said so before. But what did you wish to see me about?"
"The State Science Institute does not hold a favorable opinion of Reardon metal."
"You've said that, too."
"Isn't that a factor which you must take into consideration?"
"No."
The light was growing dim in the broad windows of the office. The days were short. Reardon saw the irregular shadow of the nose on the man's cheek and the pale eyes watching him. The glance was vague, but its direction purposeful. "The State Science Institute represents the best brains of the country, Mr. Reardon."
"So I'm told."
"Surely you do not want to pit your own judgment against theirs?"
"I do."
The man looked at Reardon as if pleading for help, as if Reardon had broken an unwritten code which demanded that he should have understood long ago. Reardon offered no help.
"Is this all you wanted to know?" he asked.
"It's only a question of time, Mr. Reardon," the man said placatingly. "Just a temporary delay, just to give our economy a chance to get stabilized. If you'd only wait for a couple of years."
Reardon chuckled gaily, contemptuously. "So that's what you're after? Want me to take Reardon metal off the market?"
"Why?" "Only for a few years, Mr. Reardon. Only until..."
"Look," said Reardon. "Now I'll ask you a question. Did your scientists decide that Reardon metal is not what I claim it is?"
"We have not committed ourselves as to that."
"Did they decide it's no good?"
"It is the social impact of a product that must be considered. We are thinking in terms of the country as a whole. We are concerned with the public welfare and the terrible crisis of the present moment, which..."
"Is Reardon metal good or not?"
"If we view the picture from the angle of the alarming growth of unemployment, which at present..."
"Is Reardon metal good?"
"At a time of desperate steel shortage, we cannot afford to permit the expansion of a steel company which produces too much, because it might throw out of business the companies which produce too little, thus creating an unbalanced economy which..."
"Are you going to answer my question?"
The man shrugged. "Questions of value are relative. If Reardon metal is not good, it's a physical danger to the public. If it is good, it's a social danger."
"If you have anything to say to me about the physical danger of Reardon metal, say it. Drop the rest of it. Fast. I don't speak that language."
"But surely questions of social welfare?"
"Drop it."
The man looked bewildered and lost, as if the ground had been cut from under his feet. In a moment he asked helplessly, "But what then is your chief concern?"
"The market."
"How do you mean?"
"There's a market for Reardon metal, and I intend to take full advantage of it."
"Isn't the market somewhat hypothetical? The public response to your metal has not been encouraging. Except for the order from Taggart Transcontinental, you haven't obtained any major..."
"Well, then, if you think the public won't go for it, what are you worrying about?"
"If the public doesn't go for it,
You will take a heavy loss, Mr. Reardon. That's my worry, not yours. Whereas if you adopt a more cooperative attitude and agree to wait for a few years, why should I wait? But I believe I have made it clear that the State Science Institute does not approve of the appearance of Reardon metal on the metallurgical scene at the present time. Why should I give a damn about that? The man sighed. You are a very difficult man, Mr. Reardon. The sky of the late afternoon was growing heavy, as if thickening against the glass of the window panes. The outlines of the man's figure seemed to dissolve into a blob among the sharp, straight planes of the furniture. I gave you this appointment, said Reardon, because you told me that you wished to discuss something of extreme importance. If this is all you had to say, you will please excuse me now. I am very busy. The man settled back in his chair. I believe you have spent 10 years of research on Reardon metal, he said. How much has it cost you? Reardon glanced up. He could not understand the drift of the question, yet there was an undisguised purposefulness in the man's voice. The voice had hardened. $1.5 million, said Reardon. How much will you take for it? Reardon had to let a moment pass. He could not believe it. For what? He asked, his voice low. For all rights to Reardon metal. I think you had better get out of here, said Reardon. There is no call for such an attitude. You are a businessman. I am offering you a business proposition. You may name your own price. The rights to Reardon metal are not for sale. I am in a position to speak of large sums of money. Government money. Reardon sat without moving. The muscles of his cheeks pulled tight. But his glance was indifferent, focused only by the faint pull of morbid curiosity. You are a businessman, Mr. Reardon. This is a proposition which you cannot afford to ignore. On the one hand, you are gambling against great odds. You are bucking an unfavorable public opinion. You run a good chance of losing every penny you put into Reardon metal. On the other hand, we can relieve you of the risk and the responsibility at an impressive profit, an immediate profit, much larger than you could hope to realize from the sale of the metal for the next 20 years. The State Science Institute is a scientific establishment, not a commercial one, said Reardon. What is it that they're so afraid of? You are using ugly, unnecessary words, Mr. Reardon. I am endeavoring to suggest that we keep the discussion on a friendly plane. The matter is serious. I am beginning to see that. We are offering you a blank check on what is, as you realize, an unlimited account. What else can you want? Name your price. The sale of the rights to Reardon metal is not open to discussion. If you have anything else to say, please say it and leave. The man leaned back, looked at Reardon incredulously, and asked, What are you after? I? What do you mean? You're in business to make money, aren't you? I am. You want to make as big a profit as possible, don't you? I do. Then why do you want to struggle for years, squeezing out your gains in the form of pennies per ton, rather than accept a fortune for Reardon metal? Why? Because it's mine. Do you understand the word? The man sighed and rose to his feet. I hope you will not have cause to regret your decision, Mr. Reardon, he said. The tone of his voice was suggesting the opposite. Good day, said Reardon. I think I must tell you that the State Science Institute may issue an official statement condemning Reardon metal. That is their privilege. Such a statement would make things more difficult for you.
Undoubtedly.
As to further consequences? The man shrugged. This is not the day for people who refuse to cooperate. In this age, one needs friends. You are not a popular man, Mr. Reardon.
What are you trying to say?
Surely you understand.
I don't.
Society is a complex structure. There are so many different issues awaiting decision, hanging by a thin thread. We can never tell when one such issue may be decided, and what may be the decisive factor in a delicate balance. Do I make myself clear?
No.
The red flame of poured steel shot through the twilight. An orange glow,
the color of deep gold, hit the wall behind Reardon's desk. The glow moved gently across his forehead. His face had an unmoving serenity. The State Science Institute is a government organization, Mr. Reardon. There are certain bills pending in the legislature which may be passed at any moment. Businessmen are peculiarly vulnerable these days. I am sure you understand me. Reardon rose to his feet. He was smiling. He looked as if all tension had left him. "No, Dr. Potter," he said, "I don't understand. If I did, I'd have to kill you." The man walked to the door, then stopped and looked at Reardon in a way which for once was simple human curiosity. Reardon stood motionless against the moving glow on the wall. He stood casually, his hands in his pockets. "Would you tell me," the man asked, "just between us? It's only my personal curiosity. Why are you doing this?" Reardon answered quietly. "I'll tell you. You won't understand. You see, it's because Reardon metal is good." Dagny could not understand Mr. Moen's motive. The Amalgamated Switch and Signal Company had suddenly given notice that they would not complete her order. Nothing had happened. She could find no cause for it, and they would give no explanation. She had hurried to Connecticut to see Mr. Moen in person, but the sole result of the interview was a heavier, grayer weight of bewilderment in her mind. Mr. Moen stated that he would not continue to make switches of Reardon metal. For sole explanation, he said, avoiding her eyes, "Too many people don't like it." "What? Reardon metal, or you're making the switches?" "Both, I guess. People don't like it. I don't want any trouble." "What kind of trouble?" "Any kind. Have you heard a single thing against Reardon metal that's true?" "Ah, who knows what's true? That resolution of the National Council of Metal Industries said, 'Look, you've worked with metals all your life. For the last 4 months, you've worked with Reardon metal. Don't you know that it's the greatest thing you've ever handled?'" He did not answer. "Don't you know it?" He looked away. "Don't you know what's true?" "Hell, Miss Taggart, I'm in business. I'm only a little guy. I just want to make money." "How do you think one makes it?" But she knew that it was useless. Looking at Mr. Moen's face, at the eyes which she could not catch, she felt as she had felt once on a lonely section of track when a storm blew down the telephone wires, that communications were cut, and that words had become sounds which transmitted nothing. It was useless to argue, she thought, and to wonder about people who would neither refute an argument nor accept it. Sitting restlessly in the train on her way back to New York, she told herself that Mr. Moen did not matter, that nothing mattered now, except finding somebody else to manufacture the switches. She was wrestling with a list of names in her mind, wondering who would be easiest to convince, to beg, or to bribe. She knew the moment she entered the anteroom of her office that something had happened. She saw the unnatural stillness, with the faces of her staff turned to her as if her entrance were the moment they had all waited for, hoped for, and dreaded. Eddie Willers rose to his feet and started toward the door of her office, as if knowing that she would understand and follow. She had seen his face. No matter what it was, she thought, she wished it had not hurt him quite so badly. "The State Science Institute," he said quietly when they were alone in her office, "has issued a statement warning people against the use of Reardon metal." He added, "It was on the radio. It's in the afternoon papers." "What did they say?" "Dagny, they didn't say it. They haven't really said it, yet it's there. And it isn't. That's what's monstrous about it." His effort was focused on keeping his voice quiet. He could not control his words. The words were forced out of him by the unbelieving, bewildered indignation of a child screaming in denial at his first encounter with evil. "What did they say, Eddie?" "They... you'd have to read it." He pointed to the newspaper he had left on her desk. "They haven't said that Reardon metal is bad. They haven't said that it's unsafe. What they've done is